This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from BFM 89.9. I'm Meera Sivasudhi. Now, after 8 years on the air, we're bringing the Bigger Pictures Health and Living to you, live, on the ground. A whole day with the experts, debunking myths behind heart disease and diabetes, addressing our love affair with food, and of course, George will be there talking about sperm. So join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on Saturday, 2nd of April. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
1MDB has been on the lips of many Malaysians and even international observers. Predominantly, the Wall Street Journal and many commentators have made comments on this company. I'm Ibrahim Sani, and joining me this morning is my colleague Julian Ng. Also in the studio and sitting in the hot seat, Mr. Arul Kanda, the President and Group Executive Director of One Malaysia Development Berhad, or globally known as 1MDB. Welcome to the show, Arul.
Thank you, Ibrahim. Thank you, Julian.
Before we proceed any further, if you would like to tell us your thoughts during this interview, you can text us at 016-201-9000 or tweet us. Now back to our esteemed guest, Arul. Thanks, first and foremost, for coming on the show. And I'm pretty sure you have been explaining and outlining and plenty of rebuttals have been coming out from 1MDB. But I guess none of them have been on radio, I suppose.
Absolutely, Ibrahim. This is my first ever radio appearance and first ever radio experience, and I'm very honoured and thank BFM for giving me this opportunity.
Now that's fantastic. Actually, the honour is all ours. Let's start with the hottest topic right now with 1MDB, as if the topics can't get any hotter. Governor Zetti yesterday has mentioned in her press conference that they will proceed with the administrative action, or so-called powers within their ambit, to actually go after the notion that the funds have not been repatriated back, the $1.8 billion, and this is with regard to the ECA, or Exchange Control Act. Why was this not repatriated back? Was there something else?
Ibrahim, as you know, Bank Negara Malaysia has extensive powers, regulatory and administrative powers, and we as 1MDB fully respect that authority of the central bank. Clearly, these are matters that happened a long time ago, and we have explained in detail to the central bank the reasons as to why we are unable to comply with their requirements. Now, in relation to the specific comments attributed to the governor, we have not received anything official or in writing from the central bank, so I can't really add to what is already in the public domain. But I look forward to sharing that as and when we do.
I think it's really interesting when you say that you're unable to comply with the institution that's been tasked to manage the systemic integrity, financial integrity of our nation. And you're both under the MOF, right? So is there such a room for non-compliance with Bank Negara requirements?
As I mentioned earlier, Julian, the central bank has the authority to demand certain actions. Now, whether certain actions can be met or not is a function of the facts of the situation.
But isn't this a case for the law to decide? It's either against the law or it's complying with the law, right?
Absolutely. And as I said, we fully respect the law and the authority of Bank Negara to impose any such action as it may deem necessary.
Okay, so you were mentioning that you have not received anything from Bank Negara, but this is with regard to the administrative action. But you have received instructions from Bank Negara to actually repatriate it back. In fact, the bank has revoked three permissions that was granted under your firm, under this ECA, for investments abroad. And this is contravening the Financial Services Act. So that paperwork has been given to you guys. But non-action following that paperwork is a contention in this question.
Absolutely. And again, there's no dispute on that fact and that point. But clearly, the $1.83 billion, which over time ended up as being $2.33 billion, in fact, a large proportion of that has already been spent on various requirements. And the balance has been designated for a debt for asset swap that we have in place with IPIC. We have explained this in detail to the central bank. They are aware of these facts. But of course, we respect their right to impose whatever sanction that they may deem necessary under the law.
So this, of course, related to that JV that you made with PetroSaudi. Can you take us through how $1 billion in 2009, which was the cost of your investment, the part of your 40% of that JV with PetroSaudi, transformed itself into an asset that's worth $2.3 billion?
Well, Gillian, I'm sure you would have seen the various explanations we have issued on this point starting from January or February last year. But if I could briefly summarize,
yes,
1MDB entered into a joint venture partnership with a company called PetroSaudi. They are specialists in the oil and gas industry, for which $1 billion of equity needed to be contributed by 1MDB for a 40% stake. 1MDB duly complied with that requirement to transmit $1 billion and received 40% of the shares. Now, over time, a decision was made in 2010 for the JV to be terminated. 1MDB converted its equity into debt by way of Murabaha and subsequently added an additional $830 million of Murabaha debt for a total of $1.83 billion. So what started off as equity was converted to debt, which was to reduce the risk to the company and generate a stable and recurring income.
Why did you take the risk in the first place and found it proper later on to reduce that risk?
Gillian, these were matters that happened before my time, so I can't really speculate on the detailed decision-making. What I can say, based on the company records and minutes of the various board meetings, is that the board at that time determined, given various circumstances, that it was better for the company to convert from equity into debt, which provides more certainty and regular income to the company.
But then you're helming this company now and you would have to take every decision that's being made, past, present and future. The thing is that there were some allegations being hurled that the assets in question that PetroSaudi was supposed to cough out, $1 billion cash that you're coughing out, the asset had no value. Can you give us some background to the story?
We can't stop people making allegations and we can't stop people telling lies. What we can do is to say, should anyone have any facts or evidence, then please do submit that to the relevant authorities.
But here you are being an institution that's owned by the people of Malaysia. I mean, those are your own words. You say that 1MDB is owned by the people of Malaysia. So you have a duty to safeguard the financial resources of the country. And you're putting money, sorry to bring this on to you, which happened before your time, but you're a rep of this organization right now. And this money was coughed out, $1 billion, not a small amount of money, against that JV. I'm just trying to get at the bottom of what exactly were the merits of that business decision.
I'm glad you talked about the bottom, because the end of it. The reality is the $1.83 billion ultimately was converted and ended up as fund units, which as of 31st March 2014 were worth $2.33 billion. From that $2.33 billion, $1.44 billion was redeemed in cash and paid out for various purposes, where there's currently a balance of $940 million of fund units. So I think your line of questioning should also take into account the end result, which is whatever started as an investment of $1.83 billion was ultimately redeemed in cash of $1.44 billion and has a balance of $940 million in fund units.
And when will Malaysians see the light of the day, these funds coming back to us?
So the $1.44 billion, as we mentioned, has already been redeemed in cash and spent. The $940 million of fund units have been designated for this broader debt for asset swap with IPIC. So when that transaction is completed, that will represent a monetization of those units in return for IPIC taking over debt of 1MDB.
These kind of corrective measures, or measures that try to address the problems, are good and dandy. If anyone has allegations, please bring it forth. Now, there is an individual by the name of Xavier André Giusto. He did bring forward information related to 1MDB. And of course, in many reports, he is considered to be blackmailing his former employer, PetroSaudi. So this is the conundrum. An individual did bring forward evidence, but is now being jailed 3 years for this fact.
Ibrahim, I think the basis of your question is entirely wrong. Justo never brought forward any information. He stole information from his employer and he sold that information to certain parties based in Malaysia. And it was because of the theft that he was jailed by the Thai authorities.
Regardless of how he obtained it, that is the closest anyone has ever come to bring forward the information to light. Does it mean that there is absolutely no way for these allegations to be substantiated because no one can actually get to the bottom of this?
Again, what you have said is wrong. I think the information from Justo was extensively publicized, for example, by The Edge magazine, whom I understand is ultimate owner of this radio station.
Not correct at this point in time.
Yes.
They were.
Full
disclosure.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that correction. Yeah. So it was extensively publicized. And, you know, interestingly, on the back of that expose by Sarawak Report and by The Edge, which happened in February and early March 2015, the government of Malaysia took immediate action by requesting the Auditor General to conduct a special audit on 1MDB, and for which the results have now been presented to the Public Accounts Committee, which has five opposition members on it. So I strongly disagree with your statement that nothing has been done, because in fact the government took immediate action the moment that news broke out.
But still, I think it is really triggering, putting a lot of authorities around the world into action. I mean, you're investigated by at least, not you, but 1MDB is investigated by at least five or six nations, the regulatory authority of those nations, including by Bank Negara, another regulatory institution in Malaysia, where Bank Negara actually originally recommended for criminal proceedings to be brought against 1MDB, and the AG's chambers shut that down. And now Bank Negara having to tweak that. I don't know if they're tweaking. That's my own words. Now they are saying that they want to bring administrative procedures against 1MDB. And in addition to that, you know, we have the FBI, we have the Singapore authorities, we have the Hong Kong, Swiss, UAE, even the UK. Does this put you into a territory of culpability?
Julian, your question has so many different parts to it. It's not one question, right? I think let's address the facts one at a time. In terms of the authorities publicly announcing what they have done, it's only been the Swiss authorities. The Singaporean authorities are conducting certain investigations, but that's very specific to banks under their purview. So not to do with 1MDB. 1MDB has not been contacted by any of these foreign authorities. And based on newspaper reports, we understand only the Swiss authorities have contacted the Attorney General in Malaysia. So let's clarify that point first. Now, I have said this before and I will say this again. 1MDB is the most investigated company in the history of Malaysia. So leaving aside the international investigators, domestically, Bank Negara, the MACC, the police, the Auditor General, and of course the PAC are all looking into 1MDB. I'm pleased to say that on the back of the earlier Bank Negara investigations, the Auditor General determined that no offence has been committed. He has given a detailed explanation, which can be found on his website, an actual statement by the AG that explains why he decided not to pursue action. So I think you should make reference to that. In relation to the other investigations, the MACC have said they are not investigating 1MDB. In relation to the Auditor General, they have completed their report. It's now been presented to the PAC. And as I understand it, based on public reports, the PDRM is awaiting the PAC report to be presented to Parliament, upon which they will decide on next steps on their side. So from my perspective, there's no possibility of cover-up given the extensive investigations that have happened. And the ultimate authority, if you ask me, would be the PAC that has members of the opposition on it, who can then opine and give their feedback on the various investigations.
Mm-hmm. Just onto a level which is a little bit more personal, why do you think it has come to this? Because if you are claiming your innocence, or if 1MDB is doing so, why has it come to this? Has it been a PR failure on the part of 1MDB not being able to explain to the public at large and to the world that you are innocent, and everyone's still making a lot of conjecture about what's happening?
Julian, let's be clear. You're putting words into my mouth by saying we're claiming innocence. What we have always said is that 1MDB is a company that has faced challenges. These are primarily business challenges, and those challenges started in November 2014, a confluence of three events, right?
Well, if you're not innocent, you're guilty, right?
Again, you are innocent until proven guilty. And what 1MDB has always said publicly is that we will cooperate with every investigative authority, and that if any wrongdoing is found, then action must be taken under the purview of the law. So we have been very consistent with that. Innocent until proven guilty is a hallmark of our judicial system. I think you would have seen that also applied most recently in another political scenario where some people are trying to say it is guilty until proven innocent, but actually it's innocent until proven guilty.
But I'm trying to really dig into the PR machinery of 1MDB and explaining what's going on to the public at large. If you had done the right thing and communicated well, why are we in the situation that we have today? And I'm holding in my hand a publication, a booklet that has been done by 1MDB, which has a lot of questions and answers. And it's pretty transparent. And yet, people still do not understand what's going on.
So, Julian, between 2009 and January 2015, which is when I took on the role, I fully accept that things could have been done better from a communications perspective. However, as I'm sure you will admit, from January 2015 onwards, we have been extensively engaging with the public. Now, unfortunately, the 1MDB challenge, which is a business challenge, was and has become politicized. And when politicians jump onto the bandwagon, when they use sound bites without reference to facts, and when they make allegations without offering proof, that is sexy. And the press laps it up and reports it as such. Our challenge is to ensure we can explain our position. But you know, frankly, facts are boring and people turn off. But this is why I'm here with you, for example, to show and to explain our position.
You were mentioning that 1MDB is facing challenges and predominantly business challenges. If I may respectfully disagree, 1MDB is anything but business. Everything is politicized. If it was business, it started off as such, but now it has transgressed into this whole realm of political instability, political notions. Individuals that were originally part of 1MDB, individuals within 1MDB, individuals that were investigating 1MDB, are now no longer there. Now, is there invisible hand moving to remove these actors?
Again, I think I've said this before many times. I'm not a politician and I do not represent the government. I can only speak from the perspective of 1MDB. From our perspective, we have always cooperated to the extent possible with the relevant authorities. And we've always maintained that if any wrongdoing is found, then action must be taken under the law.
Now, within the ambit of 1MDB, the former advisor of 1MDB, Tan Sri Samat Alias, actually left 1MDB. I personally interviewed him on this show, and he went on record to say that his requests for documents and reports to be reviewed by him went unanswered by the management. Would you care to comment on this statement?
Well, I can, because I personally gave various updates to Tan Sri Samat as part of his role as the board of advisors. In fact, when these allegations by him first came to light, 1MDB issued a statement to clarify what we had done, how we had engaged. Of course, we regret that Tan Sri Samat decided to not be on the board of advisors anymore. That is his right, and we fully respect that.
Do you think you're getting a little bit of a helping hand from the government in insulating yourself from critique and openness?
From the perspective of 1MDB, we were disappointed that the PAC proceedings did not occur per the original timeline, because frankly, we wanted the opportunity to share our side of the story and to get the facts across. So I'm pleased that we have managed to do that, albeit on a slightly more delayed basis. The content of what we presented has not changed, and I hope that the conclusions of the PAC will reflect what we have shared with them.
And have the members of the PAC, or at least some members of the government, communicated to you why the report has been delayed so many times from being open to the public?
Not to us. Obviously, the proceedings of the PAC are confidential, so I can't talk about the proceedings themselves. What I can say in general terms is that the Auditor General report was very comprehensive, very professional, very detailed, and I'm sure the PAC report will reflect all the findings that the PAC has made, not just based on the Auditor General report, but also on the interviews and additional information that the PAC has obtained.
How do you think you have done on the proceedings? If you can't reveal to us the detail of what was discussed, how do you think you came out of the proceedings?
As 1MDB, we have taken the position that we would be transparent and that we would be open. Also that to the extent PAC required or requested for information, we have shared that with them. We trust that will meet the requirements of the PAC, and we remain available for any other information that might be required.
We're going for a break. On the Breakfast Grill this morning, we have Arul Kandasamy, this group president and group executive director of 1MDB. Up next, we'll be talking about Dr. Mahathir's lawsuit against the chairman of the board of advisor for 1MDB. This is BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, on the Breakfast Grill this morning, I have with us Arul Kanda, President and Group Executive Director of 1MDB. 2 days ago, Dr. Mahathir and Khairuddin and Anani, all three members of UMNO, actually made a lawsuit against the Prime Minister, saying that the Prime Minister was incompetent in running the country. Does this sit well with how 1MDB is being run?
Ibrahim, first of all, I believe they're not members of UMNO anymore. So let's correct that fact immediately. Tun Dr. Mahathir said that 42 billion hilang, or 42 billion disappeared from 1MDB. He then changed that to say 26 or 27 billion hilang, and then a few billion hilang, and so on and so forth. Not once has he been able to substantiate these various statements that he has made. I think we find that deeply disappointing for such wrong allegations to be made about the company.
Anything that happens to Najib, Prime Minister Najib, do you think it will reflect negatively on 1MDB's management?
Ibrahim, I have to admit, I'm not familiar with the contents of the lawsuit. I don't believe it is directed at 1MDB in any way.
How involved is the Prime Minister in the day-to-day running of 1MDB? Do you keep in touch with him on a daily basis?
1MDB is a company under the Companies Act 1965. So day-to-day management of the company is by the management team, which reports to the board. Our board meets at least once a month and more if necessary. And then, you know, certain board resolutions under the Companies Act require shareholder approval. And the shareholder in this case is the Ministry of Finance. So we follow that procedure in terms of governance of the company.
Prime Minister Najib, as the chairman of the board of advisors, does he come regularly to see you to make sure that things are in order?
No,
what is the frequency of your communication with your chairman of the board of advisors?
Our communications are through the Ministry of Finance as the shareholder. There is a committee in the Ministry of Finance that was set up last year to primarily assist with the 1MDB rationalization plan. So we meet with this committee every 2 weeks or so and present updates to that committee from which shareholder decisions are then made. And the Prime Minister is not on that committee, just to be clear.
Because the Prime Minister is on plenty of committees. This includes the JKE, or Jawatan Kuasa Khas Ekonomi. He's also the Prime Minister as well as the Finance Minister. Juggling so many duties, does it impede on his deliverables, at least in the capacity of delivering value towards 1MDB?
Ibrahim, the Board of Advisors is a purely advisory entity. There is no legal authority. The legal authority resides in the management, the board, and the shareholder, which is the Ministry of Finance. I'm sure everyone will understand that 1MDB is but one of hundreds, if not thousands, of companies owned by the government. We have a clear governance procedure, and particularly when the rationalization plan was implemented, there is a specific committee made up of various professionals in the Ministry of Finance that we work with in order to implement the plan.
Why 1MDB is in existence? I mean, your name suggests that you are a development fund, but you were merely a kind of a placeholder, like a seat warmer, taking over all these power assets from local players like Anandakrishna and the Genting Group, and then flipping them on to CGN. What are your views on that?
Julian, you've conveniently left out many years of in between those two statements. The objective of 1MDB was to consolidate the power industry in order to create a bigger platform that could then compete to bid for new power projects. And that happened very successfully, for example, with Project 3B and also Track 4A in Malacca. Now, you can't do that if you are a small company. So that was the rationale for acquiring.
Why was there a need
companies.
For a government institution to be set up to do that? Wouldn't the private sector be doing that well enough?
Competition is always good, as I'm sure you'll understand. Now, in Malaysia, on the power generation side, there were a few private sector players competing with Tenaga. The government had a policy at that time of being part of this ecosystem in order to spur competition and reduce PPA power tariffs. So, and that has been proven as 1MDB bid was the lowest bidder for various
power
projects.
But the government is in a position to tweak their PPA policy. Was there really a need to start a company, burning a lot of carbon footprint, taking on 42 billion ringgit of debt just to do that? And at the end of the day, to what end, right? Because all these have been sold to the Chinese.
Julian, I think you're being very naughty by equating power purchases with 42 billion of debt in one breath.
We shall get onto that.
The debt of 1MDB started as 5 billion ringgit in 2009. And you will see that each time 1MDB acquired assets, so not just power assets, but also real estate assets, it took on more debt because that was the model of the company, which is to use debt to acquire assets.
Which is like a hedge fund model, because if I refer to your booklet again, question 4, which is on page 9, and then repeat it again on question 27 on page 41, you were capitalized at 1 million ringgit. And from 1 million ringgit, subsequently in the future years, 42 billion ringgit of debt was generated. This to me seems like a hedge fund company putting very much the country's financial resources at risk.
Well, I think the use of debt in itself is not wrong. I mean, all of us use debt. I'm sure you have credit card debt or mortgage debt or debt when you buy a car.
I don't have the, a gearing issue... ratio of 42,000 times. You see, you are going against the very foundational theory of finance about efficient capital structure. You have 1 million ringgit of capital and 42 billion ringgit of debt. That gives you a debt equity ratio of 42,000. And even if I take your 5.8 billion government guarantees, if I just take that 5.8 billion that you started off with, that's 5,800 times the 1 million that you put into your company. It sounds a bit crazy.
Well, again, Julian, I think one of the lessons that have been learned through this entire 1MDB challenge is that the use of debt, if not managed properly, can cause difficulties.
Which it has, right?
Correct. And I think there's that has been very clearly admitted from very early on. But I would like to just correct the logic that you are trying to espouse. The issue with debt is not so much quantum per se. The issue is, can you service the debt, i.e. the interest and principal, when it is due? And you will see that throughout 1MDB's existence, it has in fact never defaulted on any debt. It has always paid the interest and has always paid the principal when due. The issue for 1MDB was in 2014, November 14, when the IPO of Edra Energy did not happen. That caused a cash flow mismatch. So quantum in itself is challenging, but what caused the problem was a mismatch in cash flows.
This morning, we're speaking to Arul Kanda, the President and Group Executive Director of One Malaysia Development Berhad. Up next, we'll talk more about their rationalization plans.
You're still here. Good. Now, if you're listening to this podcast while on the treadmill, you're already off to a good start. If you're not, don't forget to join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on the 2nd of April. Find out how you can live a better, healthier life. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
Good morning, BFM 89.9. This morning, we have Arul Kanda, the President and Group Executive Director of 1MDB on the Breakfast Grill. Arul, we've covered a lot of ground on many of the issues, but I guess the core issue right now is that it seems that 1MDB is winding down their assets. Plenty of things to talk about in the rationalization aspect. Is there a clear rationalization plan on reducing the assets of 1MDB?
Absolutely. I think we were very clear in June 2015 when the rationalization plan was first announced. It comprises of a number of parts. The first part, which we have successfully completed yesterday, is the sale of Edra Energy in its entirety, for which 1MDB will receive cash proceeds. The other parts of the rationalization plan are, for example, the sale of a 60% equity stake in Bandar Malaysia. That payment is going to be deferred to match our future bond liabilities. And in the meantime, we will receive interest on the deferred payment to match the interest on the bonds. And the third part of that is a debt for asset swap with the IPIC of Abu Dhabi, in which they will assume payment of interest and principal on a portion of our debt in return for us transferring certain assets to them. So each of these transactions in totality will result in 1MDB being in a position to either repay in full its debt and or match the future interest and principal on debt that will mature in the future.
I think the issue for me as a Malaysian and as someone who's losing, as someone who's looking at how my tax money is being spent, it seems to me like 1MDB has been set up solely for the purpose of putting the country into grave financial risk, because you're capitalized at 1 million and you went on to took the purchase of all these power assets and land assets, which in my view does not have a lot of developmental benefits for the country, right? This is a power sector, very established. Property sector, really, any private sector company can do it. But what you have done is you have set up this company under the auspices of the MOF just to generate a lot of debt and take over assets and later on flipping them.
So, Julian, again, I think you've just contradicted yourself multiple times just in your statement. A million ringgit of equity, that is taxpayers' money. I fully agree with you. The rest of what 1MDB has was borrowed. So it is debt which needs to be paid back. Now, unfortunately, as we discussed earlier, the company went through a number of challenges in November 2014, primarily caused by the IPO.
You're repeating your answer. My question is the fact that it's not so much that debt can be paid off. Of course, it can if you generate enough income. But the question is the risk of putting the country resources at that. If you can't pay it off, then the country would have to bail you out, wouldn't it?
So fortunately, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that word. Fortunately, there's no bailout, Julian. Fortunately, the company, having gone through a challenging
period, really the principle of why 1MDB is being set up. You know, 1MDB has 1 million in capital. I mean, if you're setting up a fund of 5 billion or 10 billion and you're trying to make good the 5 or 10 billion rather than, you know, making this gamble of taking on debts, piling on debt so many times your capital, I mean, that's two very, very different things.
Again, the capital was all debt, let's be clear, and that debt is now being repaid. As to the success or not of the company, this is the risk in business. Not all businesses are successful, Julian. I'm sure you'll understand that.
So the government should not be taking on this kind of business risk, wouldn't you agree? And the fact that 1MDB exists today shows that this decision was really not well made. And I just want to know you as a rep again of 1MDB, what your personal views of this. Are we really as a nation taking excessive risk by setting up 1MDB?
My view is that it is dangerous to make simplistic links between statements without looking through the facts. If you look at the objective of 1MDB, it was to act as a catalyst to do things differently, to bring in foreign direct investment, and to undertake strategic projects for the government. So in the case of Bandar Malaysia, for example, you would have seen recently that a significant amount of FDI was just generated. 2 days ago, China Rail Engineering announced a $2 billion US dollar investment in Bandar Malaysia, which 1MDB still owns 40% of.
Isn't that a project that can be done by any creative and innovative company? Why should a government institution be set up solely for the purpose of doing that? And added on top of that, you have the risk of temptation, right? On the one hand, the government is in control of policy and control of access into funding, control of guarantees, and 1MDB being a conduit for those kind of those very temptations that we're trying to avoid.
Again, if you look at government involvement in the economy, it takes many different forms. Different countries have different approaches to this. This is one approach that not just Malaysia. I think if you look at Singapore, if you look at China, if you look at Korea and Japan, there have been multiple situations where government companies have undertaken strategic projects on behalf of the government. Now,
is it purely commercial decisions? What kind of KPIs have been injected into, say, TRX or Bandar Malaysia that would make a difference compared to if a normal commercial property company undertook those projects?
Julian, I think it's going to be very difficult if you don't let me finish my answers. But I will move on to your next question. In relation to TRX, the mandate was to act as a master planner for the 70-acre development. 1MDB took on an obligation to spend 3 billion ringgit to build infrastructure, not just inside, but also outside of TRX to improve traffic flow in Jalan Tun Razak. I'm proud to say that we have brought in foreign direct investment. So Mulia Group of Indonesia purchased a prime piece of land of 3 acres in TRX. We've entered into a joint venture with Lendlease of Australia, one of the largest real estate companies in the world, to jointly develop 17 acres of land in TRX. So from that perspective, I think 1MDB has achieved a part of its objectives.
You were mentioning that 1MDB has not defaulted on debts, but you needed extra debt to pay that debt. This includes borrowing 2 billion ringgit from Tanjung PLC. Is this another case of digging another hole to cover one hole?
In the case of the 2 billion ringgit from Tanjung, that was an obligation by Tanjung to subscribe to 2 billion ringgit of equity in the power companies that 1MDB had purchased from Tanjung. So there was an existing obligation for them to subscribe to 2 billion ringgit of equity. What we agreed jointly with Tanjung is instead of drawing down 2 billion of equity, we would take it in the form of debt because that gave 1MDB more flexibility to manage its ADRA monetization process. I'm pleased to say that with the announcement we made yesterday, we will be paying back the 2 billion ringgit to Tanjung in full.
Now, I just want to again touch on that TRX land, TRX project and the land that was transferred at almost next to nothing. Do you think this is fair? Because if you're going to value yourself based on commercial factors, then that cost, the true cost of the TRX land was just way below market price.
Well, Julian, important to remember that the land which was owned by the government was transferred to 1MDB, which is 100% owned by the government.
Well, you have to decide whether you're
a commercial. Sorry, can I finish my answer, Julian? Yeah. Let me finish my answer. The second point is that 1MDB undertook the obligation to invest 3 billion ringgit in infrastructure, including close to a billion ringgit tunnel under Jalan Tun Razak, direct connections to the Max Highway, Smart Tunnel, as well as upgrading Jalan Imbi to link up into the commercial and tourist district in Bukit Bintang. So each of these expenditures have to be incurred and are an obligation of the company. So whilst the land was transferred at a nominal rate to a company 100% owned by the government, the reality is the company had to take on these 3 billion ringgit of obligations.
And of course, what you're implying is that those infrastructural costs would balloon the effective land cost that was taken over by the government. Can you tell us what that cost is on a per square foot or per acre basis, the infrastructural cost adding to the cost of the land purchase?
It's approximately 1,500 ringgit.
1,500 ringgit. And would you agree that that is like way below market prices and does not reflect the commercial and competitive position of acquiring land at fair market values?
The TRX has proven that the value added by 1MDB, for example, in the infrastructure enhancement, has resulted in breaking KL benchmark property pricing. So if you look at the per square foot land prices we have achieved in the sale for Mulia Group, for example, it's in excess of 3,000 ringgit per square foot.
Yeah,
so that benefit, Julian, comes to the government because profit that 1MDB makes goes to the government.
Shouldn't you be sort of rated on a commercial basis in the sense that I feel that if you were made to pay for the land fairly, then you would work harder and that would benefit Malaysians even more?
The government has various ways of monetizing its assets. So in the case of TRX, the government made a decision for the betterment of Kuala Lumpur that 1MDB should undertake various infrastructure obligations in the site surrounding TRX. In the case of Sungai Besi, for example, 1MDB has the obligation to build and relocate 8 new military bases at a total cost of 2.7 billion ringgit in return for getting the land in Sungai Besi. So the government has multiple ways in which it chooses to monetize its assets. But what I can say in this situation is in both cases, 1MDB is 100% owned by the government, so it's not a private sector company. Secondly, although the land has been transferred at a nominal price, there were obligations that 1MDB had to take on.
So, Arul, I just have to remind you that I'm a shareholder of this company. I'm a shareholder of 1MDB, and I'm worried, right? I'm worried whether my money is well spent. I'm worried about whether you've been put into a false sense of security that you got all this land on the cheap, and that lulls you into a position of uncompetitiveness. Can you do something to allay my fears?
Well, I think, Julian, the facts speak for themselves. You would have seen the transaction 1MDB undertook with a consortium of Iskander Waterfront and China Rail, at which we sold a 60% interest in the Bandar Malaysia, the Sungai Besi land, for 7.41 billion ringgit. That values the entire parcel at 12.35 billion ringgit. And that valuation was only achieved because of the master planning 1MDB has done, because of the work 1MDB has undertaken to relocate the armed forces and so on. If you look at TRX, as I mentioned earlier, the per square foot prices we have achieved are in the sort of mid 3,000 ringgit range or even 4,000 ringgit range. That should allay your fears that the assets of the company are sufficient to pay back the debt of the company.
Question number 26 from your booklet. Is it true that Tabung Haji bailed out 1MDB by purchasing land at TRX at an inflated price? Why did you feel the need to defend Tabung Haji, which is an entirely different institution from yourself?
We were merely stating the facts, which unfortunately had been clouded through various political agendas. The fact is Tabung Haji participated in a tender process for that plot of land. They won that tender process fair and square. And we sold the land to them at a price which was highly attractive and approved by the Tabung Haji Independent Investment Panel, as well as their board.
So did you sell the piece of land to them? And for the record, you have put it here as 2,860 ringgit per square foot. Is that below the market price, below the commercial value of the land?
It was a very attractive price based on
for
the
Tabung
tender.
For Tabung Haji, but not for 1MDB, right? Which I am a shareholder of.
I'm sorry. Again, you can't have your cake and eat it.
Okay, but you
please,
also...
Please, if you could give me some comparables in terms of land prices.
I will, in fact, and the comparison is given by your own answer. A comparable piece of land that was purchased by Mulia Group was priced at 4,400 per square feet. So it seems to me that you have given
okay,
this
discount...
Okay, so Julian,
you have to compare apples to apples.
Yeah,
the Mulia land...
I'm just using information from your booklet.
I know, but please compare apples to apples. The Mulia land is a commercial plot, and if you look through the plot ratio, so the amount of floor space that can be built on that plot is higher for the Mulia land versus Tabung Haji. So generally, residential land is cheaper than commercial land. And secondly, how much you can build on that land in terms of the plot ratio also determines the valuation of the plot.
So a lot of these examples that you're given around the purchases in the surrounding area, for example, with WCT Group and Malaysian Resources, Oxley and so on, they are trading at over 3,000 square feet up to 4,400, including that one that was bought by Afin. Are you saying that what you have sold to Tabung Haji was a fair price or was it a discount to Tabung Haji?
As a seller, we were happy with the price. As we mentioned, it was part of a tender process and that was the price that came out as a result of the negotiation. So we are pleased. They were one of the first movers into TRX. We believe that land has a lot of value for them. And by virtue of them, who are, by the way, a major investor in real estate, that has provided confidence for us to sell plots to other buyers.
Now, we were talking about prices of between 2,800 to 3,400 per square foot. I'm referring to Tabung Haji paying that amount and former being Tabung Haji, latter being Mulia Group. The highest payer right now is Afin Group at 4,700 ringgit per square foot. Is there a correlation between the fact that your chairman of directors, Tan Sri Lodin Wok Kamarudin, is there a fact that connects the two entities together, because after all, he is the CEO of LTAT, the primary owner of Affin Bank. Is there a connected party here, and was the transaction very much muted? Yeah, an arm's length transaction.
Absolutely, it was an arm's length transaction. Tan Sri Lodin abstained from all discussions on both sides, both on the Tabung Haji LTAT side and the 1MDB side, in terms of the decision making. The reality, which you have to acknowledge, is that TRX is the financial district for Kuala Lumpur, and I think Affin Bank made an excellent decision in purchasing a prime plot with good road frontage and connectivity to the rest of the TRX.
Now, this is not located just or restricted within Tan Sri Lodin Wok. Tan Sri Ismi, who is also your board of director and who is also sitting as the CEO of Tabung Haji, is also, you know, a connected party. So I'm getting a foreboding sense that things are not really at arm's length. Could you care to comment on that?
I absolutely deny what you have just said. I think that is potentially libelous. As we mentioned, the relevant directors abstained from decision-making. Both institutions are major players in the financial landscape of Malaysia. I think it is only right that they have the opportunity to invest in what is going to be an extremely attractive real estate proposition. More importantly, I believe both institutions have very clear processes in terms of investment committees, board approvals, as well as regulatory hurdles that they have to go through. So I'm sure those decisions were made with the best and correct governance as appropriate for the situation.
Now, back to square one then, because while we have all this corporate governance in place, while we have all the standard operating procedures in action, this is going back to all these allegations that it's still standing. So I'm pretty sure you've done all you can, in fact, more than what is required to actually explain the position of 1MDB in all these arm's length transactions. Yet, the adventure that we are on here as Malaysians is that 1MDB saga still continues. What went wrong?
I think we can't stop people making allegations and we can't stop people telling lies. What we can do is to give our side of the story, not so much to convince people, but rather to show a balanced picture. And ultimately, Malaysians have to decide based on the facts and based on their own opinions, what is the truth and what is not.
Not taking anything away from you, you did say that you're not a politician. Is it right for us to now see a politician come into the fray and take the executive arm of the management and try to see where we can do with this, resolving all these criticisms and scandals?
Oh, sorry. I'm not sure what you're referring to, Ibrahim. Can you clarify your question, please?
This is very much a political issue, and you have said that you're not a politician. Is there a need for politicians to step in?
Let me be clear. What I have said is that 1MDB is a business issue or a business challenge that has been politicized. I've never implied at any point that a politician should take over 1MDB. From my perspective, I was brought in to do a job, and that job was to help the company resolve its challenges. Alhamdulillah, I can say that we have achieved that. So we have achieved the sale of the ADRA Energy assets. We have monetized 60% of Bandar Malaysia. And we are very advanced in the process of monetizing other assets. With this asset monetization, the debts of 1MDB will be repaid and or will be matched so that they can be repaid when they become due. From that perspective, if I could liken us to a situation where we had a car crash in November 14, we were in the ICU for the whole of 2015. In 2016, we are now in the normal ward. We're doing physiotherapy, and I hope we'll be out of hospital by the end of the year.
I'm just wondering whether you were driving a little bit too fast above the speed limit for you to end up in the ICU, you know. And this brings me back to the idea of this excessive debt. And in connection to that, all the kind of debts, the bond issues that were handled by Goldman Sachs, they were paid an extremely high fees for that, according to normal investment banking standards. Sources from the media would have it that the fees as a percentage of total issuance, anywhere between 7% to 11-12%. Was there a need to pay Goldman so much fees?
Gillian, each transaction is assessed and priced based on the specific risk factors and credit considerations at that time. So from 1MDB's perspective, they went through a process to establish what they needed, how much they needed, how fast they needed the funding.
But why so expensive?
And which, I'm trying to explain, Julian, and which bank could offer a transaction that met all those criteria. So when you want to borrow a lot of money quickly, in one shot, from one institution, there is a price to pay. Now, what's more important, though, is having borrowed the money, are you able to repay the money? That's really the crucial part of it. I'm pleased to say that based on the rationalization plan, 1MDB is able to do so.
Well, I would have to disagree with you that that's the only crucial part of it. The price of issuing that debt would be very important as well. I mean, you're, of course, paying coupons of 4-5%. That's normal. But the fees in the first year and one-off is already more, is equivalent to a few years of coupons. So effectively, the coupon of your debt for the first 2 years is double, perhaps triple, given that you're a government institution, perhaps triple of what the normal coupon rate of the debt is. In addition to that, I mean, if you shop around, you're a government institution, if you shop around people like JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, they've done all the other deals around the world for very much cheaper at, to the extent of 0.3%, 0.5%. You're paying 9, 10, 11%.
I'm not quite sure what you're trying to imply, Gillian. If you feel that there was any impropriety in
I'm just asking why you were not in a position to negotiate for a better price.
Well, again, I think from what I can see based on company records, the company went through a process in order to raise its funding. That process had an assessment by various institutions as to size, quantity, price. And there was an ultimate fee that needed to be paid. So I'm afraid I can't comment any
more
than
Aro,
that.
Sorry, Aro, what process is that?
The internal 1MDB process. So for every process, every time 1MDB appoints an advisor, it goes through what's called a beauty parade, where different institutions are asked to bid for a particular role. So in this case, Goldman Sachs was one of the bidders or providers of financing.
Well, this beauty parade seems to have chosen the ugliest deal in town. That's why I just want to ask, you know, some degree of transparency as to what that process is, what led to the decision of selecting Goldman as one of the most expensive service providers to handle your loans, your debt.
As I said, this was the best option for the company at that
why
point
is it the
in
best?
Time. As I told you earlier, given the size, the speed, and the fact that one bank was willing to underwrite the entire amount, therefore taking away execution and transaction risk, came at a price. And the company determined that that was the best solution
so
for it at that point in time.
According to a media report by The Edge, the Uruguay government of international bond issued almost 2 billion US dollars worth of bonds, and they paid a fees to Deutsche Bank and HSBC equivalent to 0.1% of their issuance.
I cannot comment on that specific issuance as I don't know the details, but there is a very big difference between a fully underwritten bond whereby a bank undertakes to take the entire issuance on its balance sheet, regardless of whether or not the market purchases the bonds. From what you have quoted in terms of that fee and my experience as being an investment banker, I would have thought the Uruguayan bond was not underwritten.
Okay, so if that's not underwritten,
Julian, I'm not sure what benefit we are achieving through through this discussion.
This is the money of the nation. 11% of the bond value, bond face value, has been spent almost for nothing. And now the FBI authorities in the United States is investigating whether there are improprieties as far as the procedures of Goldman Sachs are concerned.
Again, I think you're trying to make a reference from the Wall Street Journal attributed to an unnamed source with no verification or confirmation into a fact. Unfortunately, I cannot comment on such speculative statements, Gillian.
But there is a fact that Tim Lissner, the individual connected to Goldman, he is being subpoenaed by the grand jury.
Again, we do not know that as a fact. I think it has been referenced to unnamed sources in the Wall Street Journal articles.
Now, it has attracted a lot of attention, some of the assets that you're winding down. This includes the Air Hitam asset in Penang. It has attracted more than two suitors. In fact, just yesterday, Titi Jaya and Suina has jumped in. Is this going to be a trend where a lot of these companies are now jumping in? What is the probability of local companies snapping up more of these assets instead of foreign companies coming in?
Well, first of all, if you look at Bandar Malaysia, through the sale process and through the sale to the consortium, the effective ownership of the ultimate project, right? So if you look at it that way, 1MDB owns 40%, so we're the single largest shareholder. KPRJ, Kumpulan Prasarana Johor, which is Johor State Government, owns 14%. IWH, Iskandar Waterfront, which is also Malaysian, owns 22%. And CREC of China owns 24%. So 76% of Bandar Malaysia is Malaysian-owned, of which 54% is owned by state and federal government. In relation to the Air Hitam land, we are still going through a process. There's been a lot of interest in the asset, which we're very pleased by. It looks very likely that it will be a domestic or local developer who will take over that, who will become a JV partner to help us develop that asset.
Now, I'm pretty sure you're midway through your rationalization plan, and I'm pretty sure that you could call this a success. Is there a point in time right now where you might want to pull the handbrake and decide on, you know, developing some of the assets for yourself?
We are, in fact, keeping TRX. So TRX is being developed by 1MDB. Apart from the plots of land that we have sold, we are developing the rest of it. In terms of Air Hitam, we will partner with a developer. So the land is ours. They will bring in the capital to develop the asset. In terms of the plan itself, I would say the plan is done. We have executed legally binding agreements for all the key components of 1MDB's debt. What we are now doing is completion. So tying up the loose ends, fulfilling certain conditions precedent before completion.
Now, of course, then the question is, what will 1MDB do? Because if you want to look at the creation of 1MDB being a government entity and trying to develop 1MDB to become beneficial to the state, there's many others that are doing the same thing. One of them is Khazanah, and they have a going concern basis. They don't plan to wind down anytime soon. What is the core reason why 1MDB was created? How is it different from institutions like Khazanah?
First of all, let me clarify. There are no plans to wind down 1MDB. Rather, what we are doing is, given the significant negativity that has surrounded the company and the need to repay debt, given the challenges, as we discussed earlier, where there was a significant cash flow mismatch, we are disposing of certain assets in order to pay back debt. But we are actually retaining Bandar Malaysia, or a significant proportion of Bandar Malaysia, as well as TRX, which is land that was given by the government. So what we would like to do is for these projects to become standalone, independent companies in order for them to continue and monetize the projects to the best possible level and not be tarnished or bogged down by the negativity that's in 1MDB as a holding company.
Now,
so does that mean that 1MDB would turn itself into just a landlord?
I would describe it as more to become a non-operating holding company, whereby the operating companies will be these subsidiaries that will have independent boards and independent management to run them and execute the project. So that's particularly true in the case of TRX. In the case of Bandar Malaysia, the consortium, which is led by Iskandar Waterfront, will take over the day-to-day management and development of that project. Similarly for Air Hitam, the developer that we choose will take over the day-to-day management of the project. There's one land we haven't spoken about, which is the Pulau Indah land. That will be sold outright.
So just hypothetically speaking, if 1MDB sold off all its assets today, would it end up in surplus?
Absolutely.
Okay, surplus. How, to the extent of how much?
Approximately, depending on the exchange rate, approximately 3 billion ringgit.
3 billion ringgit. Would you think that the government should take its money off the table today and spend that 3 billion ringgit in much more socially productive ways?
Okay, that's a good question. And in fact, we went through this analysis. Now, in my view, the land assets that 1MDB has have significant future potential. Equally, in order to repay the debt, the remaining debt that we will have on our books would be the long-term bonds. To redeem the bonds, you have to pay up the full interest up to the maturity. So over time, inflation increases the value of assets, development increases the value of assets, but inflation reduces the value of debt. So there's a positive jaw that gets created. Having done the analysis, our view was that it was best to continue developing the assets, gain additional revenue and income, and use that over time to meet the interest as well as pay the principal of the bonds when they mature.
So talking about interest, just some mathematical issues to dispense with. We started talking about the 42 billion ringgit debt at a time when the ringgit was a lot stronger than it is now. And we all know that the ringgit has weakened tremendously. What has that ballooned the 42 billion number to something that's higher?
Most definitely. The debt amount varies every day depending on where the exchange rate is. I think what's relevant for your listeners is that all the debt that now remains will be long-term, so bonds that are due in 2022, 2023, and 2039. So over that space of time, we will be able to generate from the current transactions payments of interest to match the interest payments, as well as to develop and monetize the assets in order to meet the principal payments.
So you sold EDRA to CGN for a total sum, including a debt assumption of 17 billion. Is it as simple as 42 minus 17, or that 42 number has come up to such a level where it becomes meaningful to discuss that number?
So it's almost accurate. So if you take 42, I mean, if we base it on publicly available figures, I think that's the easiest comparison. Out of the 17 billion ringgit of value from the CGN transaction, about 8.5 billion of that, about 8 billion plus of that is actually inherited debt that will transfer to the new buyer. So in terms of the net equity value, so the cash, it's approximately 9.8 billion ringgit. Of that 9.8 billion ringgit, we will spend almost all of it to reduce and repay debt. So we'll repay about 14 billion ringgit of debt in total. So 8 billion of debt transfer and about 6 billion ringgit of debt repayments.
So if I 42 minus 17 is 25, and if I peg a weakening of 30% on ringgit, I think that's a conservative number. As you say, it changes every day. Conservatively, 30%. Does that make 42 minus 17 is 25, but pegging a 30%, that 25, has it ballooned to 33?
Well, if you look at the US dollar bonds, so we have $6.5 billion US dollars of debt. So that's already 26 billion ringgit at today's values. And then if you add the 5 billion ringgit Sukuk, that takes you to around 31 billion ringgit.
And we will be able to see the math of this with the audited accounts, right? Because I would love for you to comment on this as to why so many of the auditors were changed. And it started with Ernst & Young and then KPMG, and now Deloitte is the guy that's
okay.
The auditor.
I'm glad you asked that question. If you look at Ernst & Young, they were auditors appointed by the previous shareholder of 1MDB, which was the state of Terengganu, when 1MDB was the Terengganu Investment Authority. So when the federal government took over as shareholder, as is very usual in such circumstances, a new shareholder will appoint its own auditor. So in fact, the first audited accounts of the company were done by KPMG, who audited it for 3 years in a row. And the last 2 years, it's been audited by Deloitte. So the next change was from KPMG to Deloitte, and that happened at the time 1MDB purchased its power assets. Deloitte, as you know, is the largest accounting firm in the world, and a decision was made based on a proposal from Deloitte where they committed 15 audit partners regionally and domestically for the interests of the company. So after 3 years of KPMG, we moved to Deloitte. I think it's very important to highlight that 1MDB moved from one Big Four firm to another Big Four firm and not from KPMG to Alibaba and Chong Co.
That's correct. And in fact, those have been your public statements. But I'm just wondering whether we can go an extra step of verifying this. The statements being made to the fact that Ernst & Young was fired after it couldn't agree or question profits earned at PetroSaudi, according to your board minutes.
Again, the change of auditors was done per the relevant procedures and the considerations of the company at that time. So unfortunately, I wasn't there, so I cannot go beyond what is in the company records and what the company has said publicly.
I guess these are the kind of the banter that people have in the coffee shops and, in fact, in the international press as well. And they're just asking, hey, why are all these auditors being fired?
I think what's more relevant is typically, you know, if there is any impropriety or wrongdoing, a Big Four firm would not take on a role. All of them have very strict compliance procedures, know your client procedures, and client due diligence procedures. So the fact that we move from one Big Four to another, to me, should allay a lot of those concerns. I just wanted to make it clear to your listeners that, you know, the challenges in 1MDB are very clearly documented. The company has admitted this very early on and taken steps, for example, bringing myself in, the strategic review and the rationalization. Now, whilst we can all debate about what happened, the reality is there are a number of investigative authorities trying to establish the fact. And in my mind, they will show in much detail what has happened and what went wrong or what went right. What's important is that we now need to move on. And the rationalization plan is exactly that, to show to the rakyat that although this company faced various challenges, it is able, using its own resources, to sell the assets that it took on using debt and to repay the debt. So from that perspective, I hope the rakyat will be confident in the success of the rationalization plan. And this has been publicly acknowledged. For example, yesterday, Moody's ratings agency also highlighted the benefit of what has transpired through the 1MDB rationalization plan.
So Moody's Investor Services yesterday did mention that 1MDB no longer possesses contingency risks. But this has, again, if I may repeat myself, not cleared you on the banter, the coffee shop banter. So at the end of the day, folks who are listening to this show, what kind of assurances can you give them in the clearest language possible?
In terms of having an objective perspective of what happened based on the facts, I think you will need to rely on the lawful authorities and particularly the PAC report to Parliament. In my view, that is a comprehensive, professionally prepared process, and I'm sure that report, when it comes out, will show the facts of what had happened. In terms of opinions, we respect that people have different opinions and different views. All we seek to do is to share the facts from our side, and ultimately everyone has to come up to their own conclusions. But in relation to the biggest concern of Malaysians, which is in relation to the debts of 1MDB, I'm proud to say and pleased to say that we've achieved what we set out to do, which is to repay the debts and or to match the future maturity of the debts with stable, steady and defined cash flows.
Now, I just want to ask, what was going through your mind when you were asked to assume the mantle of being a president and group chief executive officer of this very controversial company called 1MDB way back in January 2015?
Well, frankly, I looked at it purely as a restructuring job because that is my background. I'm a restructuring professional. I've been an investment banker with a legal background. Little did I expect the investigative aspects of it and also the political aspects of it. These came or happened after I took on the job. Frankly, it has been a great learning experience for me. I've made some mistakes along the way, but overall, if asked whether I would do it again, most definitely. And why would I do it again? Because I'm here to help solve a problem.
And you believe the problems have been solved?
Absolutely.
Arul Khanda, President and Group Executive Director of 1MDB, on The Breakfast Grill this morning. Arul, again, thank you very much for coming on your first radio show.
Thank you, Ibrahim. Thank you, Julian.
And that's it. Julian Ng and me signing off. Ibrahim Sani, this is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.